You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we speak with an activist with Down syndrome who works to improve the lives of all people with disabilities. We'll learn about her bill later in the program. But now, the FDA has authorized second COVID booster shots for anyone over the age of 50 and for some people with weakened immune systems. The agency says it wants to boost waning immunity among at-risk people ahead of more possible COVID waves. We're talking about the latest COVID news. We want to hear what you think. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Are you planning on getting a second booster shot? Give us a call. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. On the line, we have Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor and Director of the Masters of Public Health Program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Molly.
Well, I'm glad you could join us. Why did the FDA decide to authorize second boosters at this point?
Well, you know, the data from around the world are showing that when people, a few months out of the last booster, the antibody levels are waning. We're at a point in the pandemic in the U.S. where cases are clearly lowering, but we can't expect them to stay low for forever. We're going to have a future surge, and it's important to get the more vulnerable adults boosted again to protect them from severe illness.
And so why is the age 50? I mean, who should be getting the second booster?
Yeah, so I'll say that initially the thought was that getting a second booster for people who are 65 and older was a more obvious sort of cut point. The FDA lowered that to 50 because here in the U.S., about a third of people who are over 50 have some underlying condition that puts them at risk for severe illness. So the cutoff was lowered to be more conservative, simply because it really is important to avoid as many hospitalizations and worse outcomes when cases return.
So who is exactly eligible for this second booster? What types of people beyond those, anyone over 50?
Yeah, so people have an underlying condition, and that could be, for example, obesity. And we know a lot of people may fit that, may be obese. People with hypertension, diabetes, other comorbidities that put them at risk, for that severe illness. Also, of course, we can't forget there are a lot of people with weakened immune systems who are also eligible for being boosted again, simply because we know from the beginning that those individuals have some of the worst outcomes for COVID if they were to be infected.
And so is this becoming like the flu? Can we expect annual boosters?
You know, the FDA is going to be convening their advisory committee on April 6th to sort of think about a new framework for the future of boosters. So let's sort of wait and hear from them to see what the future may look like. I think we can expect to have recommendations to be vaccinated against COVID in the future as new variants emerge. Maybe there'll be a new strategy other than the platforms we're using right now, but time will tell whether we can improve what we have at the moment. They're excellent right now, but we could do better so we can potentially avoid repeated boosters. But having something in the future is going to be needed because we can expect this virus eventually to become a little seasonal, where more of the transmission is occurring during those winter months, like a lot of respiratory viruses, when a lot of respiratory viruses spread.
So I've read some articles about mixing and matching the varieties of vaccines, mixing Moderna with Pfizer and vice versa to increase your immunity. What's your thought about that?
Yeah, there have been some studies done showing that when you mix the vaccine types, the types of platforms that are being used, you get some benefit. It stimulates the immune system in a way that you get sort of a broader array of antibodies that are produced. So the recommendation generally is to get boosted without a doubt. But if you were to mix and match, there is some added benefit to that from the data. You have a choice, and some people might choose a different vaccine for their booster if they felt like the first one produced reactions that they want to avoid this next time. So there's maybe lots of reasons for people to mix and match. But it seems like if you do that, you might get a higher quality response. And so there's some experts who will advocate for that.
Sure. But meanwhile, people with kids under five are still waiting. Where are we at with the research on a COVID vaccine for young kids?
Yeah, April's going to be a big month. Both Pfizer and Moderna have plans to submit their data to the FDA for review. Overall, for both of those vaccines, the safety profile looks good. That what really becomes the issue is whether or not you can get enough protection from the doses that are being given to children for each of those vaccines to make it worth sort of authorizing. And it looks like we will be able to do that, but we've got to look at the data first. The issue has been a bit of a roller coaster for the Pfizer vaccine, where they initially thought two doses would be enough, and then it turned out three doses might be needed. And that happens to be a vaccine where they're testing 1/10 of the adult dose for children under five. So a low enough dose that you don't expect as many reactions if you give an adult dose to a child. But unfortunately, it wasn't as immunogenic. So a third dose is needed, and we'll have to see what the data reveal. For Moderna, they're aiming for two doses, a quarter of the dose that adults get, so a little bit higher, and therefore only two doses needed. And they indicate that it will be good data to warrant authorization, but again, we have to see what the FDA says. I think parents are just going to have to hang tight a little longer for a few more weeks, and we'll see what happens.
So what would you think is maybe best case scenario if the results come back good, if they're released in April? When would we see these appropriate levels of doses available, potentially hitting pharmacies?
Yeah, I think the supply is there. I think what's going to happen is parents will maybe be a little hesitant as to whether they want their young children vaccinated. We often, you know, hear about the anxious parents who are waiting for the vaccines to be authorized. But when you look here in Wisconsin for 5 to 11-year-old children, their parents, have not necessarily decided to get them vaccinated. Only 27% of children 5 to 11 are vaccinated. So under 5, I imagine we might see even lower rates of vaccine uptake. And if children had infection during the Omicron spike, I imagine parents are confused as to what to do. I'll say that when the FDA reviews these data and the CDC makes recommendations, I hope parents recognize that, kids getting COVID is not the kind of thing we want to take a chance on. Kids can get long COVID, and getting vaccinated does protect them against that. And, if the data shows that they're safe, it'll be worth getting simply because the chances of getting COVID will be potentially high in a future surge.
Well, I'd like to go to the phones now. We have a caller in Slinger. Mike is on the line. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon. So my question is, I've gotten my three shots. My booster is at 5 months, and I want to get the fourth shot. And I've got Moderna, Moderna, and Moderna. So when I go to my provider, as soon as I can request a Pfizer. And will they do that, given that I've had a Moderna, Moderna, Moderna?
Good question. Thanks, Mike.
You can request Pfizer, and you can get Pfizer as your next dose. And some people might say that's a good choice. Others might say stick to Moderna. So I think you'll have to talk to your provider to decide what's best for you, but you'll have both options available.
We're talking to UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi about the FDA authorizing a second COVID booster and other COVID news. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Parents, love to hear from you. Are you planning to get your kids vaccinated against COVID once it's available? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking with UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi about the COVID vaccine, additional boosters, vaccines for kids, the possibility of seasonal COVID shots. Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Ajay, I'm wondering what the status is currently of the BA2 variant that's currently circulating.
Yeah, so just this week, the CDC declared that this is now dominant, that somewhere between 51 and 59% of new infections is caused by BA2. And just last week, that was 39%. So surely in a couple of weeks, we can expect almost all infections to be due to this new subvariant. It's a little bit more infectious, about a third to 50% more infectious than sort of the original Omicron that had caused a spike in January. And we can expect that to be the dominant form until another variant comes around. So even though cases are lowering right now, we now are dealing with a virus that's in the US that's more infectious. So over time, when we see that increase in cases, it'll be caused by BA2 or another variant in the future.
Well, and what's your advice as an epidemiologist for how people should, how seriously they should take this, considering that many people are vaccinated, many others are taking precautions, and some people are feeling quite done with this pandemic? How do you advise people to consider distancing, masking, other precautions?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, right, there's a lot of pandemic fatigue. We all feel it. And we are at a point right now where cases, you know, are on the lower side. We can expect that surge later on. So I think people should, you know, appreciate where we are at the moment and understand we do have a lot of immunity out there. There's some estimates by the CDC that 95% of Americans have some kind of immunity, whether that's from vaccination or previous infection. The problem is not everybody with any immunity has enough immunity to protect them against severe disease. So number one, everybody needs to be up to date on vaccination. There are too many people who just have not received all the doses recommended. Maybe they're completely unvaccinated. It's about 15% of society that's really holding out on that. And it's unfortunate. We also have about 15 million seniors, people 65 and older, who haven't been boosted yet after the primary series. And those are going to be the most vulnerable individuals the next time we have a surge. Now there's a recommendation for a second booster for people 50 and older. I'll say that, you know, in the meantime, we should not forget our masks. We should keep them nearby. Even though COVID is lower right now, it's not gone. And I personally choose to wear a mask indoors in public settings and try to avoid exceptionally large gatherings. And if I'm in the middle of a gathering, I don't worry as much as it was maybe last winter or during the winter. But, you know, I'm still cautious and I'm aware of the local epidemiology. When we start to see higher cases, it's important that we all become aware of that. So let's not forget that COVID is still out there.
Yes. Well, I want to go back to the phones. We've got a lot of calls coming in for you, Ajay. Let's go to Pewaukee next, where Peter's standing by. Good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I am 70 years old, and I've had the two vaccines and the booster. Would it be wise for me to extend this last booster up until the fall season so that the next booster would be working during the most vulnerable months of fall and winter?
Great question. Thanks.
Yeah, Peter has a good question. It's a question that we all have. I would say, you know, at 70, that's an older age. Getting a booster sooner is better than probably later, especially if he has underlying conditions, then really the time is now, since the last booster was some time ago. I recognize sort of why people would want to time the booster so that they have that protection when cases are increasing. Thing is, the cases are already out there at the moment. There's enough spread to be able to pick it up, and it's not a bad idea to get boosted. But I think when you have questions, it's important to just, you know, default by to talking to your doctor and deciding with them what the right choice might be. But the recommendation is to get it sooner than later.
Thanks. I want to go next to Richland Center, where we've got Paul on the line.
Hi, thank you very much. Your guests may not know the answer to this question, but for those of us that really want this second booster, who's going to pay for it? Because my wife heard that the government's not going to pay for this one because they don't have any money to pay for it. Is Medicare going to pay for this? Is our private insurance and supplements going to pay for it? Are we going to be paying for this out of pocket? And I'm sure it's not going to be inexpensive. And I guess I'm just wondering, who is paying for the second booster? I haven't heard anything talked about that.
Yeah, I think it's currently being debated in Congress. Ajay, what do you know?
Yeah, I'm not aware of people having to pay for second boosters right now. Indeed, federal funds are declining for supporting COVID testing and some other things. But I think right now that booster is paid for. We'll just wait over time to see, you know, what the federal government is going to do as there's greater demand for boosters and there's more uptake. But you can assume right now that it's going to be covered until we hear otherwise.
Thanks. Well, we've got more calls coming in. Let's go next to Madison. We've got Tom on the line. Good afternoon, Tom.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm around 60 years old, so I grew up with firsthand stories about polio and smallpox. And so the idea of going to get my booster shot or my, you know, any vaccine I needed just to go to, in, you know, to go to elementary school was just common. But today we have this politicization of vaccines and just common sense responses to COVID. And what can we do to overcome this politicization? Because, I mean, right now there's one party that's trying to kill all of the funding for COVID, and we can't deal with that. We need to have both parties on board.
Thanks, Tom. Ajay, what works? What works when you talk to people who may be hesitant?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what works sometimes because there's been a lot of conversations about this, and we still have, you know, people who are hesitant. We still have a politicized pandemic. It's not surprising because the pandemic affects every aspect of our lives. It has been. And so it's not surprising it's become politicized. I think what's daunting is when every aspect of the way we handle the pandemic, whether it's testing or a new vaccine or monoclonal antibodies or something, there's an argument for everything that's based on ideology, unfortunately. I'm a big believer in just, you know, chipping away with one conversation at a time with people who may not agree with you. It takes patience. It takes a lot of listening and just being open that just remember that everybody who makes decisions bases their decisions on what they feel to be true, even if it's different from what you feel to be true. I think we just have to sort of be patient with each other, have these conversations. And you know, the caller also talked about, you know, pandemics of the past. And I'll say that a lot of people do change their tune when they lose a loved one to COVID or they experience severe illness. It's a terrible way to learn that lesson, but it's another way where people do change their minds.
Yes. Well, let's go next to Milwaukee, where we have Tom on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm wondering if the constant need for boosters is largely contingent upon the fact that most of the world has not been immunized, and so we keep getting new variants.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you know, the need for another booster is based mainly because the antibodies wane after the third boost or that third shot. Indeed, we do want to stop COVID from spreading around the world, but that is going to take time. That's the reason why we're always vigilant for future variants, because the virus is still out there spreading and mutating and evolving. But the need for another dose is really to boost the antibody levels, simply because that's what's required. They're calling it a second booster, but you really could look at that first booster as the third dose in the primary series. We're making these decisions in real time based on scientists coming in real time. And it's clear that three doses is definitely needed to get protection. And now this additional dose called the second booster is going to help for the more vulnerable people.
All right, let's squeeze in one last question. We've got Mona in Appleton. You're on the air. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering on a couple things, mixing the seasonal flu shot with the COVID, if they're going to combine that. I would not be on board with that because I had a pretty harsh reaction to my second Pfizer, but my booster 7 months later, I did not. I was eligible. I got it when I was eligible 7 months later. And also, as far I'm 60 and I don't have any underlying health conditions, do I really need a fourth booster?
Gotcha.
I don't have the underlying. And how long can I wait?
Gotcha. Yeah, we've just got a minute left. Ajay, what do you think?
I'll say in general that the FDA won't authorize any future vaccines where the safety profile is not in favor of people getting it. So if there's a combined vaccine in the future, it'll only be authorized if the reactions are, you know, things that we can handle. I totally respect your having a bad reaction for one of the doses. My third dose for Pfizer wasn't great, but my first two were fine. Sometimes you can prepare yourself for that dose, you know, just avoiding caffeine, avoiding alcohol, getting good rest, and that can maybe help. There's a lot of anecdotal data out there, but getting that fourth dose is really important if you're vulnerable for severe disease. So I would recommend that.
Well, thank you so much. That's all the time we have, but thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Molly.
I've been speaking with Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor and Director of the Masters of Public Health Program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Lee Rayburn speaks with a Wisconsin journalist back from reporting on the Ukrainian refugee crisis from the streets of Poland. Well, the spring migration has begun. And apparently that includes flamingos, too. Wildlife officials have confirmed reports of a flamingo that escaped from a Kansas zoo 17 years ago. It was a dark and stormy night back in Wichita in 2005 when two flamingos made a break for it. One flamingo was never to be seen again. The other escapee, known only as 492, has since been seen over the years up and down the country, including Texas, Louisiana, and yes, even here in Wisconsin. Officials say they know it's the same bird because of a distinctive leg band. Zoo officials say they don't plan to recapture this free bird. So keep an eye out next time you're on Bascom Hill. I'm Molly Stentz. In for Rob Ferret, you're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Amtrak announced a new train route that will connect the Twin Cities with Chicago. We'll learn more about that coming up. But first, the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control have come under fire for categorizing Down syndrome as a birth defect. Disability rights advocates say that Down syndrome is not a birth defect, it's a genetic condition. They argue that calling it a birth defect reinforces existing stereotypes and misconceptions about Down syndrome. 3 decades after the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities still face discrimination in many ways, some of which are codified in law. Our next guest has spent years advocating for the rights of people with Down syndrome, like herself, and she's got a bill, the Charlotte Woodward Organ Transplant Discrimination Prevention Act. Joining us now is Charlotte Woodward, the Community Outreach Associate for the National Down Syndrome Society. She's also a senior at George Mason University. Charlotte, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
We're so glad to have you. I'd love to hear a little bit about your work and what made you want to become an advocate.
Well, I am a student at George Mason University, so I would probably say it was my education that snowballed me into becoming an advocate.
Yes, and I understand that you had a heart transplant when you were 22, and I understand that you were quite lucky that you had to wait only 11 days on the transplant list to get your surgery, which is quite rare. How did you realize that your experience wasn't common?
Well, that goes back to when I was diagnosed with a congenital heart condition. And as I grew, my heart couldn't keep up with the rest of my body. So I would have fainting spells during which I would collapse. But thanks to my doctors, they advocated for me to get that life-saving transplant. And I want to point out that had I not received my heart transplant, I wouldn't be here today. And that transplant was the only thing that would save my life.
Wow. And I understand that there's a study from Stanford that says that intellectual and developmental disabilities are often used by doctors as a factor in determining whether someone can even get a transplant?
That is unfortunately true. But I would like to add that may at some point no longer be the case because of my bill, the Charlotte Woodward Organ Transplant Discrimination Prevention Act, which seeks to eliminate discrimination, and that discrimination can crop up in several places. For instance, doctors may decide not to refer a patient with a disability to a transplant program, or transplant teams could deny a transplant and not put the patient on a transplant list because of their disability. And another thing I want to point out is that why do we need such an important bill as the Organ Transplant Discrimination Prevention Act? Well, that's because people are traveling across state lines as well as organs. And so there is a lot of ambiguity there on a local level, despite NDSS's push for local and state laws. And that's why we need a strong federal bill. And there are two Organ Transplant Discrimination Prevention Act bills. One is called the Non-Discrimination in Organ Transplantation. That's the state bill, and that is through the House. Or I say
on the state level.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. That's on the state level. Mm-hmm. But the Charlotte Woodward Organ Transplantation Discrimination Prevention Act that has a two bills in on the federal level, one introduced in the House and another introduced in the Senate. How did it become a Senate bill? Well, that's because of a tragedy involving the case of a baby named Zion who was born with Down syndrome. But after 5 days of intensive surgeries, he ended up dying right after he was denied a transplant. And Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Hassan used that as momentum to get it introduced.
And this bill that you've worked on, would require that doctors not solely consider a disability when they go to make recommendations for patients to get transplants. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. And of course, this bill I had just talked about would take an emphasis off of the disability, because for a long time, people with disabilities have been saying or have demanded that people like doctors and other people in society to just see people with Down syndrome and those with other disabilities to see us as people, not our diagnosis.
Yes. How long have you been working on this bill?
Oh, I've been working on it since 2018. And I would like to add that I didn't really know all this stuff about organ transplant discrimination when I had my heart transplant, so it was kind of a shock when I learned about it. And I would like to add that this discrimination is the majority of the time rooted in fear and ignorance and bias.
Concerns that there wouldn't be adequate care after surgery.
Correct.
That you some doctors correct. Say that as for I'm why they would make no. those decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'd like to add that that's the case only if patients don't have an adequate support network. But if they do have an adequate support network, they are able
yes.
to make those decisions.
And that's the work that you're doing. Where does the bill stand now?
Right now, the bill is still in the House and Senate, and we have had over the past several months efforts in talking with U.S. Representatives and senators to get co-sponsors, and we're still pushing hard. But I'd like to add, on the organ transplant front, that we are in the 21st century. You would think this issue would be a thing of the past.
Yes.
But as you can tell, that's not the case.
That's not the case. Well, we will keep watching the efforts in this bill, and we will watch your work. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
I appreciate you being here. Charlotte Woodward is the Community Outreach Associate for the National Down Syndrome Society. Last year, a bill to prevent organ transplant discrimination was named after Charlotte in honor of her work on the issue. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about someone whose life was saved by doing his job.
When we're at work, we all have a number of roles. We can take on other jobs, wear several hats. Albert Watson is a detention officer at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center, where he also hosts a cooking club. Here, he tells the story of the day he saved a life by taking a bit of his own advice.
I had 10 minutes left of my shift before it was time to go home. I was headed to the control room to relinquish my equipment when the timer went off. I informed my coworker, Walter, that I'd head back to the pod to check on the male youth. See, every 25 minutes, our policy is to check on every kid that's in their room. This was the kid whose mood seemed to change as the day went on. seemed like the more people he talked to, whether it be his social worker, public defender, the police, the more emotional he became. I've been a detention officer for almost 10 years at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center. I've been training for a lead worker position and recently became the president of the Wisconsin Juvenile Detention Association. For the past 5 years, I've facilitated a cooking group at detention. No, I have not been to culinary school. My passion for cooking started with my dad. I'm the oldest of four boys, and my dad would get us up at 6:30 a.m. just so we could eat breakfast, consisting of sausage, salt pork, homemade biscuits, eggs, and tomato gravy. Yeah, I'm crunching in the sugar sandwich. My dad could take some neck bones and barbecue them in the oven and make us licking our fingers shortly after engaging that dish. So when I cook with these kids, it's from the heart and with love. We made many dishes over the last 5 years, from deep fried Twinkies and Oreos to fried chicken and waffles. We've done homemade meatloaf, five cheese macaroni, lasagna and homemade garlic bread, patty melts, paninis. We always like to celebrate other cultures. So during the month of March, giving respect to the Irish, we did corned beef and cabbage, shamrock shakes, and bangers and mash, which isn't really an Irish dish, but was one of the recipes that popped up when I Googled Irish dishes. And I can't forget the Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid is special when you're locked up. I bet y'all wondering, what do the kids get when they don't earn the lunch? They get hot dogs. Hot dogs I boil for about 4 hours. All I do is keep adding water to them. These turkey franks go from looking light brown color to this pale off-white spongy Vienna sausage frank. I once added green food coloring on St. Patrick's Day. I'm a damn fool at work. Some people think it's mean or cruel. I call it get your together. I can't reward negative behavior. You can't disrespect staff or be verbally abusive and earn the lunch. You can't steal a car on Wednesday night, get locked up, and earn the special lunch on Thursday. We'll shoot for next Thursday. The point I'm trying to make is, do your job. A kid that's incarcerated has only one job, and that's to follow the program so you can get the hell up out of detention. As I entered B-Pod, I walked to a room, B3. As I opened a small window of B3, I wasn't sure if what I was seeing was real, but it was. The male youth was hanging from the side of his toilet sink. I radioed for staff to call 911 and asked for assistance in B-Pod. I then opened the door of B3 and entered. Walter had just arrived. I instructed Walter to open the first aid drawer and grab the scissors from the first aid kit. And once I had the scissors in my hand, I began cutting the part of the sheet that was wrapped around this kid's neck. The kid let out this grunt of a sound, which let me know that he just might be okay. I gently placed this kid on the floor and wrapped several blankets on him to make him as comfortable as I could. Continued to talk to him and assure him that he was going to be okay. The point I'm trying to make is that I was doing my job that day. That timer went off after 25 minutes, and that kid needed to be checked. A good thing happened from doing my job, and that's what I try to teach these kids during their short stay at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center.
Albert Watson's story came to us from the podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. He's a detention officer at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center and just finished his term as president of the Wisconsin Juvenile Detention Association. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, we'll learn about a new Amtrak train to connect Chicago and Milwaukee to the Twin Cities. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. A new Amtrak train will soon be running through Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois. The route, called the Twin Cities Milwaukee-Chicago Route, will travel between, you guessed it, Chicago to the Twin Cities, making 8 stops in Wisconsin. The route's an extension of the already established Hiawatha Line connecting Milwaukee and Chicago, as well as the Empire Builder, which connects Chicago to the West Coast. And today, we have with us Terry Brown, the Vice President of Public Relations for the Wisconsin Association of Railroad Passengers. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Molly.
Good afternoon. I'm glad you could join us. Let's start with this route. So we've got the Hiawatha, we've got the Empire Builder. How will this route work?
Not much differently than it already is, quite honestly. There's a little bit of improvement needed on the Canadian Pacific main line, the freight line over by La Crosse and into Minnesota up to Winona. And the Hiawatha is in process of having some improvements on the line. So Canadian Pacific has said that when the Hiawatha improvements are finished, the TCMC can roll even before the TCMC construction even begins. So the three projects that have to happen for the Hiawatha improvement is the station at Milwaukee Airport. The second platform has to be constructed. I can't believe Canadian Pacific freight trains actually roll through the Milwaukee station right now. It's a crazy scene if you catch it sometime. The second project is a creation of a cutoff that goes through what's called Mosquito Yard, just south of the Milwaukee Intermodal Station.
Yeah.
That will get all the freight trains out of the station. And then they have to improve some signaling for a couple miles west of the Milwaukee station downtown.
So is this why we won't actually see this new train until 2024? There's all
yes.
these additional construction projects happening in order to make it work. When I first heard this announcement, I was like, hey, a new train. And then I saw, wait, 2024?
Yeah, you know, these things don't happen overnight. And then there's this thing called COVID that came along and some yep. supply side shortages. When I hear the passenger rail and the freight rail managers talk about their own projects, the first thing that always comes up is the lack of steel to make steel for the rails. So boy, we're in a tough situation. That's just one of a couple things going, but quite honestly, the concession from Canadian Pacific allowing the TCMC to start before the improvements happen in La Crosse and Winona, Minnesota, is huge. That's unprecedented in the United States, quite honestly. So, very, very pleased with Canadian Pacific over that. We're kind of hoping that, you know, we get a nice summer and maybe a light winter. Maybe we'll have a Christmas present for Christmas 2023, you know, maybe. Mm-hmm.
And so passengers will see the same stops at the same stations across Wisconsin?
Sort of. The Empire Builder does not stop at Milwaukee Airport, nor does it stop at Sturtevant. So the TCMC offers people in the Racine-Kenosha area and travelers that are going direct from the airport access to Columbus, Wisconsin Dells, La Crosse, Winona, Minnesota. That's a unique bonus for the people that live in the far southeast Wisconsin area.
Direct to the airport. Gotcha.
Right.
I've taken that Empire Builder, but the other direction, west.
Right. But think about it. If you live in La Crosse, and I understand catching a flight out of La Crosse is crazy expensive, even before COVID. And say you decide you find a cheap airplane ticket out of Milwaukee to your destination. How do you get to Milwaukee Airport from La Crosse? Well, the Empire Builder was an option, but it stops in downtown Milwaukee. How do I get from downtown Milwaukee to? Well, hey, right. If when the TCMC comes, you can go right from the station in La Crosse to the airport station. One and done.
Nice. And I understand there's some shuttles also, maybe to the Madison area?
Maybe. That's been talked about. It's on again, off again. Yes, I personally know some people in Madison that would utilize the shuttle to Columbus to ride the train. Van Galder has bus service. I'm aware of that. The timing is not ideal. I get it. But man, maybe in 18 months, something will come along. What Amtrak and the Wisconsin Department of Transportation has talked about in the name of a shuttle is a shuttle that meets up with the TCMC train in Toma and carries people to Eau Claire. There's a lot of people in Eau Claire that are happy about that. They'd rather have a train, mind you, But the fact that there's a shuttle bus that'll take them from Eau Claire to Tomah just to catch the TCMC train is good.
Gotcha. Well, we will keep an eye on this as it rolls along. Well, thank you, Terry, for joining us.
Certainly.
That was Terry Brown, Vice President of Public Relations for the Wisconsin Association of Railroad Passengers. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at kids and social media and what's being done to affect their mental and physical health as they increasingly use social media.